international politics, finance, and the mentality of foreign cultures. Athens, Rome, London, the Middle East, Thailand, and Africa provided the crucibles that melded business, political, and economic intrigues in Peter's experience, giving him real-life stories that could make bestsellers in and of themselves. In each of these places, Peter met a variety of spiritual figures who appeared in his life to confirm his conviction that spirit transcends the religious beliefs that tend to divide people. Peter had an affinity for writing, and in the late 1990s, he acted on this talent, winning a first literary prize for his very first short story at the highly respected Santa Barbara Writers' Conference in California. Shortly thereafter, Peter took first place out of 500 entries in Francis Ford Coppola's online Zoetrope magazine for the first publicly circulated short story, The Blood of Our Departed. Peter continued his track record of writing excellence with the publication of Pope Annalisa, which immediately won the Nautilus and Independent Publishers Awards in quick succession, followed by the National Best Book Award. In Pope Annalisa, Peter explores an ancient spiritual tradition which cut across not only Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also the so-called pagan mystery schools of ancient days. With 25 years of voluminous research behind him in both mainstream and alternative religious spiritual studies, with a particular interest in early Christianity, Peter is a leading expert on Gnostic and other ancient spiritual traditions. He travels the country as a speaker on such topics as parallels between Gnostic mysticism and quantum physics, the sacred feminine, Mary Magdalene, and the lost women of the Bible, and the secret teachings of Jesus. Peter's skills helped him break down these complex spiritual themes into simple and entertaining fiction, and the result is Pope Annalisa, a combination of this research and information channeled in his own meditations. Peter's hope is that this crossover novel, part thriller and part spiritual wisdom text, will point to a new paradigm transcending the dead-end dogmas of religious, cultural, and gender differences that have caused so much suffering in the human community. I think you will find this amazing conversation with Peter a great excursion into the information that made the Da Vinci Code so powerful, and take that thrust to an entirely new level of depth. Peter's skills and passion are quite evident in this conversation that is sure to further illuminate this understanding of our shared religious traditions in the Western Hemisphere. And so now, Fresh Perspectives proudly presents Transcending the World's Religions with Peter Canova. Thank you so much for joining me today in Fresh Perspectives.
Nice to be here.
It's really been an interesting conference already so far, and you're going to be starting your presentation tomorrow. What is the title of it?
Spiritualism at the Christianity, really, at the intersection of spiritualism and quantum physics. It's really a story about an ancient spiritual tradition that was recovered. And it shows a whole lost history, holds the lost side of Christianity and Judaism that has information in it that has some very striking parallels to modern theories of quantum physics. But it also gets into history of lost Christianity, lost women of the church, Mary Magdalene, the sacred feminine. Covers a kind of a number of topics under the umbrella.
And you're focused on Gnosticism, is that correct? The mystical side of Christianity, the more revealed personal side?
Yes, that's right. I had some personal experiences in my own life, and when I came across the Gnostic Gospels or the Gnostic text, it really resonated, it struck a chord in terms of my own personal experience. So I became interested in Gnosticism and uncovering the history of the Gnostics and some of their beliefs, which is kind of hard to do because many of their texts were destroyed by the Orthodox Christian Church.
Right.
And I had already had a little bit of a background in quantum physics and so forth. So I kind of combined those streams with my desire to write, and I produced a novel, a series, a trilogy called The First Souls Trilogy. And the first book has already been published, called Pope Annalisa. So I decided to try and give the benefit of my experience in fictional form rather than do a self-help book.
I think that's a brilliant thing to do, actually, because it gives you the opportunity to be creative in the expression. And when you talk about Gnosticism and quantum physics in the same sentence, I mean, it's definitely evocative.
most people probably don't even know what
I mean, it sounds completely desperate, like,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Most people probably don't know what either of them are by definition, which is one of the reasons why it's, it kind of helped to do it in the form of fiction, because I was able to convey some fairly complex ideas mm-hmm. from both those fields. Mm-hmm. Through the action and the characters and the story that people can identify with, and they can kind of absorb it slowly, because it is material, that does take some slow absorption for most people to understand. Mm-hmm. So, rather than do kind of another scholarly work or self-help book, of which there's a plethora of those on the market, and right. a lot of people are doing those, and I figure they're doing them well, so why should I, throw my fuel into the fire? I decided to take a different course that not too many people are doing. And the interesting thing about it is, the book has been out about 6 months. It's won 5 national book awards.
Wow.
And what I find in the reviews and from the people that are reading it is it's almost equally divided between those people that are just looking for a good, exciting story, a thriller, and those people that are looking for spiritual content.
Well, Dan Brown did that in a sense with The Da Vinci Code, which was a brilliant success. Mm-hmm. And he brought a lot of information through that most people would never even read about if it weren't put into a mystery form.
Right.
So were you inspired by that, or were you already doing this before they even happened?
The funny thing is I know Dan Brown. I've met him. Mm-hmm. He when I was in my former life, when I was in the development business, he actually used to come down to one of our resorts. And I had a couple conversations with him. To tell you the truth, no. His book had no influence on me whatsoever. In fact, I think mine was probably written even before The Da Vinci Code. But, since I was not a full-time author at that time, it took me almost 10 years to really do this book on an on-and-off basis. And I think he wrote The Da Vinci Code in the ensuing years and got that out of the gate. He was already a published author, of course. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I wasn't even aware of The Da Vinci Code at the time I started my book. But although the differences are, there's some superficial similarities to the book.
Oh, I wouldn't, yeah.
Dan's book, I think he had a little bit of a different focus, and he kind of only scratches the surface of many of the issues that I go into in depth.
Mm-hmm. What inspired you to go so deeply into such enormous research about Gnosticism and humanity's origination?
It's really personal inspiration. When I was in my 20s, I had some transformative experiences in my life, and I touched a higher intelligence that, it wasn't fantasy. These are things that prove themselves out in the real material world in terms of the information that I was getting. I am a Capricorn. I'm practical. I'm not I'm not kind of out there on a limb. So I always believe that if you're talking about spirituality, if it doesn't have a practical application, then it really doesn't do you a whole lot of good other than academic
right.
interest. So,
What happened? Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. When I was in my 20s, I started working with a group that we were really working to sort of heighten our perception, heighten our, I guess what you would call ESP back then, extrasensory perception, non-ordinary perception. And lo and behold, I found out I had a really clear channel for intuitive medical readings. So I remember the very first case that I did, you were allowed to do was you would have a person who was sitting opposite you, like you're sitting here, and they would have an index card with the name, age, and address of a person, and then medical information or psychological profile on them. All they were allowed to do was give us the name, age, and address. We had to basically fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this gentleman's heart kind of tilted at a funny angle, which indicated to me that the aorta seemed kind of pinched. And I said, well, I believe this gentleman had a blockage in his aorta. And they said, well, that's correct. And what else can you tell us? And I said, well, I see something metallic down at the bottom quadrant of the heart, which indicates to me that he has a pacemaker. And they said, that's correct. And can you tell us when the pacemaker was installed? So I saw the hands of a clock spinning wildly, and then they stopped dead at, I shouldn't use that word, bad choice of words, they stopped still at 10 o'clock, which indicated to me 10 years, and that was in 1975, so I said I believe he had the pacemaker installed in 1965, and that was correct. So from that point on, I did hundreds of medical readings accurately, and that led me, it opened up a channel. Other phenomena I was doing, were clairaudience, clairvoyance, remote viewing, even psychokinesis. And, I said to myself, how is it possible that I can have this kind of information about other people's physical or emotional state or about the very essence of their personality and they're hundreds or even thousands of miles away from me.
Right.
And it really led me to believe that we are all connected by some form of an unseen, subtle energy and an energy matrix, in effect, and that we really all are one within this energy field, so that we can, if we know how to do it properly, we can tap in, mm-hmm. you know, from information anywhere in the field. And I believe that people are connected at these subtle and unseen levels. And I just decided to, you know, pursue that whole line of inquiry, and it led me into all kinds of research and the spiritual and psychic field, and then, you know, later on into groups like the Gnostics, who essentially were doing these things 2,000 years ago,
right.
without the aid of all the technology and the accumulated knowledge that we have today.
I have a question that's come up several times, and you're a perfect person to ask, because you talk about the divine feminine, the divine masculine. Is the divine feminine and the divine masculine, is that really a human intervention on just pure, undifferentiated source? You know, is that something we've kind of created, kind of like we created the Greek gods, we created these deities, you know, in different religions?
No, I think it's actually more than that, because I do believe there's an undifferentiated source, but I also believe the undifferentiated source differentiated at
right,
that point.
Right, in a certain duality.
And, you know, in the apparent world, we do have a duality that we call yin-yang or masculine and feminine, mm-hmm. and there's a whole set of qualities and attributes that go with each of those aspects. So the one manifests itself in different aspects in this world, and the most fundamental polarities of that are the masculine and feminine. And that's even been recognized. I mean, that just runs throughout everything. We even have the bicameral brain or the left and right, the brain hemisphere theory, where, you know, in science they talk about the left and the right brain being your more feminine, you know, intuitive feeling, the left brain being your more logical, analytical, you know, the left brain seeking to break things down and analyze, the right brain seeking to combine things into a holistic picture. And these are attributes that each of us possess. In other words, it's not like it's all male and it's all female.
Right.
Each of us have the male and the female qualities in us. And the interesting thing about the Gnostic text is that Jesus was frequently quoted in those texts saying the two must become one. And then things really start to move. You start to move mountains. And what he really meant by that was that when we balance these two sides of our natures and we bring them into an operating symmetry, then we start to open up the path to enlightenment, because then we're using all our faculties, which we really need. If you think of the path to enlightenment, or taking a rocket ship to enlightenment, you would say that the male qualities, which is, you know, sort of defining your goal, analyzing it, setting a direction, is the guidance system. But the rocket fuel, the energy that actually gets you there, is that intuitive female side that has the desire and the creative quest, mm-hmm. you know, to seek the unknown. So you really need both of these faculties in you as a person to really get you kind of out of that humdrum material world and spur you on the path to your own spiritual pursuits.
Oh yeah, and most people don't realize it, who are into affirmations and creating manifestation, that most things in life come out of a feeling sense much more than a thinking sense. But you need the thinking sense in order to get the feelings correctly directed.
Yeah, I've often said that. I think a lot of the whole affirmation thing gets a little bit one-sided, because it becomes too much of an intellectual and mental exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to build up your desire, and you have to incorporate that feeling, you know, like I say, to give it the fuel to give that whole thing lift off. Otherwise, you're kind of spinning your wheels.
Right. Agreed. So what do you feel is the most progressed and truthful way to find one's life's purpose or mission?
You know, there's no generality about that. There's no maxim or aphorism that I could, you know, drop to people to say, well, it's this way or it's that way. I think it's a process of things, and I think as a process it's really unique to each individual. I have my own, you know, beliefs about our purpose in life, which is really tied to our origins. What, you know, why I believe we're here kind of dictates what I think our purpose is. I mean, I can tell you my own personal version of that.
Sure.
But you know, I really feel that we at some dimension of our being, we are pure consciousness, and that pure consciousness It is. It exists. It's being, but it's not necessarily experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that that consciousness projected itself outward to the point where it could forget the purity of its own consciousness to think of itself as an individual entity, as something apart from the whole, to give us a sense of individual experience and individual identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we devolved from pure consciousness into consciousness and experience, or physical bodies, then our purpose is to evolve back to that state of pure consciousness. But in so doing, to bring that experience of materiality back with us. So I guess a shorthand way of saying that is maybe we're here to materialize the spiritual, while the spiritual is, you know, that we bring back the experience of materiality to the spiritual, and then we get the experience of spirituality while, you know, well, hopefully while we're still in body. And that's what the Gnostics were saying. So that the ideal state is we experience salvation while we're still alive, because we understand the essence of our spirituality. We remember the essence of our spirituality and are part of the oneness. So we know we are God, but we also know we're ourselves.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting to me because it's never resonated with me when I see different pathways say, oh, you know, the whole goal here is to kill the ego, to destroy the individuality, to go back to oneness. I'm like, what's the point then of this even existing if it's not a situation of soul at play?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's all it really is. I mean, maybe it's what Shakespeare said, we're just all actors on a stage and this is a divine comedy.
Well, it's often been said that God is playful, and that even in the tarot, you know, you have the card called the Fool, and it has the, you know, sort of this guy almost like a hobo, a wanderer, and he's about to step off a big cliff and plunge over the abyss. That was all a symbolic of God and the stepping down into material existence. It was described as creative, it was described as playful, and you know, the Hindus have a great saying that this world is the playground in which God fools himself. I think that I think the whole thing about destroying the ego and that kind of like aggressive attitude, you know, so sort of like in America we like to war on everything is a
right.
War, is that we don't war on the ego, destroy the ego. I do believe you need to still your mind and take your focus off the purely material, because if you don't do that, then you are trapped. But you don't have to destroy it. I think the ideal situation, like I said, is to become both. Is to have a recognition of, to have an enlightened recognition of your oneness, but at the same time recognize your individuation, so that you know yourself to be God, but you know yourself to be yourself.
And
I think that's the ideal state.
And to be mortal, and to be immortal at the same time.
Immortal, and yes, that's the key, mortal and immortal at the same time, because I believe we're a chain of being. Behind you and I think, lie 1,000 steps of consciousness at different levels. And, you know, perhaps we're the end product. Maybe we're sort of the ground level, the basement floor of that process. But, you know, I don't, a lot of people view that as like a fallen state. I don't really take it that way. I actually think it's a glorified state.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I do believe that there are probably intelligences that have never incarnated, what you want to call them, whether you call them angels or eons or whatever name you want to give them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's something missed in lacking that experience, because then they are being, but they are not experienced. They have not brought the experience of materiality back to that dimension.
Mm.
I do believe that our essence survives in that other dimension, and that our memories of material experience will survive there.
What do you do personally to touch into your divine source? What is your practice? If I can use that word.
Yeah,
Or is it just every day getting up?
What I've found is, no, I mean, I do meditate, and I don't have any set standard meditation practice. Sometimes I breathing is involved in it. I do find that if I visualize my consciousness raising with a breath in, and then kind of when I breathe out, I'm sort of, you know, breathing out my everyday waking consciousness, I sometimes find that technique useful. Sometimes I just count down from 10 to 1. I use a variety of different methods because I'm kind of comfortable at this point that I feel when I've arrived at my state, so I don't get so hung up on the methodology, like, oh, I missed one word in my mantra, I got to go back again. You know, when you first start to meditate, it gets kind of like that. You concentrate more on the form than the substance. So I'm comfortable with my meditation now, and, you know, I do it in different ways. And the interesting thing about it is that when you get to a certain point, that veil between your everyday waking consciousness and your higher consciousness starts to break down. So that most of the channeled information that I got, for instance, when I was writing my book, happened while I was sitting in a chair watching TV.
Did you find it? I've written a number of things too, and I've noticed that if I start the track, it's like starting the path, starting the hike. It's like that first motion gets something going, and then the creative flow comes in, and then you become a channel for the divine. I mean, things come to you like, I didn't know I knew this. Was that your experience when you were writing?
Yes. I think when your root motivation is a desire to help other people by communicating something that in your own life you have learned as being valuable, that it propels that process that you're talking about, where the energy really starts to flow.
Mm-hmm.
I think that root desire to be of service in some way, or to communicate something that would be valuable for other people, at least the way I see it, I think has helped that process a lot. But yeah, it's like anything else. When it's practice, I said to people, much of my life I felt like I was sitting in front of a radio and I was getting static. And I just kept turning the knob until at one point a clear channel came through.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that it was always out there and it was broadcasting 24/7. Now, it took work and desire on my part. And, for most people, it doesn't just happen like when you're sitting there and all of a sudden this flash of light happens and, you start communicating with higher intelligence. I think for most people, it takes work and desire. But once you do hit that frequency and you stay with it for a while, then it stays with you, and it starts to project into your life in the form of synchronicities and, in other ways that it's guiding you and telling you stories about your own life. Sometimes it got weird because I used to have so many synchronicities happening to me when I first got into this. It was like I was sitting back and saying, well, why not just sit back and watch the movie of my life? It's basically telling
somebody's got to address you.
It's telling you what I'm doing here. So, yeah.
So what is really engaging you right now? What's your most what's the greatest challenge you're facing that's bringing the most growth and interest to being alive?
Trying to market my book, which has been a huge challenge.
Hey, listen, it's definitely part of the whole structure. There's different parts of life, and I think we go into these avenues of our endeavors. Whether it's the marketing or the writing it, just getting through a block or whatever.
Well, I say that half jokingly because, in all honesty, this gets into the balance that we're talking about. There's really two parts to life. I mean, I was in a certain frame of mind when I wrote the book. I have to be in a whole other frame of mind to go out and market the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that is taking time away from the writing of the second book. So I think one of the challenges is, I don't know if it's different with other people, but for me, when I put my energy into something, I like to really put my energy into it. Having to sort of divide that energy now between the more contemplative aspects of doing the second book, and this is not easy material I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to take the material I'm talking about, which is quantum physics and a very complex ancient spiritual traditions that are hard for most people to understand, and break those down to make it simple enough to be read and enjoyed in the form of a novel without putting people to sleep is no small challenge.
No way. Yeah, it's amazing.
And so it does take a lot of energy and effort to put into that. And I guess the biggest challenge I'm facing now is, budgeting my time and energy out to perform these different functions of marketing the first book and writing the second book.
And what have you learned? I mean, how do you describe your book, the book that is completed?
Yeah.
What's your elevator pitch is the old standard in the industry, but how would you describe it quickly to an audience or to an individual?
I had to sort of make up a genre for it because there really wasn't one. I had to put my shoes myself in the shoes of sitting in front of, let's say, an agent or a publisher, and they're always so genre-oriented. What's your genre? Like, what's your sign? And I call it a spiritual thriller. And that's really exactly what it is. That's really exactly what it is because, as I told you before, I'm finding in the reviews and in the feedback I'm getting in the book, people equally enjoy it for the read, for the mystery, the suspense, the action, the drama in it. Those people that aren't really metaphysically clued in just really like it as an entertaining book. But those people who are spiritually oriented, it's been very profound for them, even life-changing for a lot of people that they've been telling me the content of the book is. And it's inspiring in a way that most self-help books couldn't be inspiring, because you're identifying with characters, so you have more of an emotional connection to it. I think when you read a self-help book, by and large, you're still operating out of the intellectual side, out of the left brain side. But if you read a good, engaging novel, and you start to identify with the characters, now you're involved both intellectually and emotionally. So you're using that left and right brain together. And I'm a big believer that when you use those things together, that's our greatest learning process, our greatest learning opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And also takes the focus off of you and judgment. Because if you're living through this character who's going through a progression of events that brings them to new realizations, you're just having fun with it. If you have a self-help book, you're looking at it, it's like, well, I don't know if I get this, and how do I apply this, and you start to look at all your details, I think it would make you very inward.
And I think also, when you write a self-help book, you've automatically put the reader in like a student-teacher relationship. Because the person who's writing the book is the guru, and you're the grasshopper. And I think in a novel, it's a level playing field. Everybody is in the same boat. If you write a good novel, you're not even conscious of the author. Mm-hmm. You're identifying with the character. Say, yeah, that's a little bit of me. I've been through that before, but I never kind of connected the dots in this particular way, And that's the possibilities of the novel. That's one of the reasons why I chose that form.
What's the synopsis of the story for the readers, for the listeners out there?
In the year 2025, it's a fairly bleak world out there. We're running out of natural resources very quickly. The great powers are kind of contending for the resources that are left. America's an overripe economy, never quite kicked its oil habit in time, and it's in an almost semi-permanent state of depression. Meanwhile, the West and the Islamic world have reached a very dangerous flashpoint. Iran has gone nuclear and is making a play for becoming a strong regional power in that area and cutting off oil supplies to America to starve America out. And the countries are ready to go to war. Then all of a sudden, a nun comes from out of nowhere and starts performing these miracles that haven't been heard of in 2,000 years in Africa. And she comes under investigation by the Catholic Church because there's a body of prophecy out there that says such a figure will appear and will be the downfall of the Church and lead the world order to ruin, and she will fool even the elect, meaning even those from the world of religion. Mm-hmm. She's got many enemies in the Church because of this, but lo and behold, she heals the Pope, who becomes critically ill. And upon that healing, he has an epiphany, and he feels that she is going to play a role in a spiritual renewal. And he brings her into the Church as the first female cardinal. And then through a very dramatic event upon the death of the Pope, which I will not reveal because it probably gives away too much.
No, I don't have to. But it's come already.
She becomes the Pope, and then the world really goes to hell in a handbasket. America does go to war with Iran. They're on the verge of a nuclear exchange. The Catholic Church breaks apart over Annalisa and her reforms. There's a real question throughout most of the book, three quarters of the book or more, as okay, what's her agenda? Is she really going to be the savior, or is she the cause of all these problems that we're seeing? Were the prophecies really correct? And it's very ambiguous throughout much of the book. And I think there's antecedents to that, because if you take a look at the figure of Jesus of Nazareth back in his time, a lot of people thought he was a sorcerer. What some people call miracles of healing, other people called sorcery back then.
Right.
So around great figures, you always have opposing points of view. And that doesn't necessarily mean the good guys automatically recognize the good guys and the bad guys, bad guys don't like the good guy. I mean, it's not all that clear cut. The dividing line between good and evil and error and clarity is not always so clear. And that is evident throughout the book. Then perhaps even the source of good and evil are one and the same source,
right?
Which is a hard thing for a lot of people to swallow. But that's the plot line. And essentially, four people who surround the Pope are racing against time to learn her secret before the world gets into annihilation.
Right.
They're racing against time to find out what the secret is of the Pope, because as she goes, so goes the world.
Fascinating. Sounds like a great movie.
It was written very cinematically, and almost everybody that's read the book says, I can't wait for this to be a movie. So I think it would make a great movie.
Sounds fascinating. Well, what spiritual metaphor for duality is easiest for the average person to understand? With all your research, you would probably have something.
A spiritual metaphor for duality. You know, I think that on one level, I would just say it's the well-known yin-yang. But on another level, I would just simply say that it's just the observation of ourselves as human beings. Now, we talked about the one becoming the two and the two becoming the many. So the one differentiated itself into the male and female poles, and then from then on, creation spread out in a almost endless projection of spirit outward and outward.
Mm-hmm.
So I would really say the thing that's right in front of our noses is just look at us as human beings. Men and women are both human beings, but they're also men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And although, like I say, all women don't display all women womanly qualities, feminine qualities, and all men don't display all masculine qualities, there still is a divide there that we can readily distinguish between,
right,
you know, aspects of that are more female and aspects that are more male. So if we simply look at the state of our own existence, which is that we are all one as human beings, but we are differentiated into male and female, that's almost the, you know, as it is above, so it is below. That's the macrocosm reflecting the microcosm.
Perfectly put, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to your talk. Should be interesting.
Well, hopefully a few people will show up and have the same sentiment.
What's the name of the talk?
You know, that's a good question. They actually changed it to kind of at the last minute, but I believe it's Christianity at the intersection of mysticism and quantum spirit, quantum physics. I'd probably have to refer to the program to get you the exact verbiage of it.
But that's
generally the gist of what it's about, and it covers all these topics that, you know, we've been discussing here. It's going to be at noontime tomorrow, February 13th, here at the Expo.
Great. Sounds to me like you should be down there. You know, the Catholic Church should be bringing some of this in. They might be able to mitigate some of their problems coming up.
You know, it's very interesting, but as I was writing the book, I came across seminarians, nuns, workers at the archdiocese, and you would be really amazed, I think, how ready Catholics are for change. And I think a lot of them were excited at the notion of a female pope. And I was told the other day by a guy who had been in the seminary that there's a sort of quiet and rising interest in Gnosticism.
I would think.
But you got to remember, Gnosticism is a huge no-no for the Catholic Church.
They're the ones that cut it all out.
Yeah, anything Gnostic is heretical. In fact, the Church, the greatest heresy, and I use the word heresy in quotes, that the Church has ever faced has been Gnosticism, because the original Christians were Gnostics.
Right.
Gnosticism was a huge stream. There were two branches in early Christianity. One was Orthodox and one was Gnostics. And the Gnostics, more than likely, were there first. Gnosticism so pervaded Christianity that even today in Orthodox Christianity, they wouldn't admit it, but there's still elements of Gnosticism that survive. You can read all of St. Paul's material in the Bible, and that can be read two ways. That can be read from a Gnostic point of view, or it can be read from an Orthodox point of view. And what we call New Age today, all the various spiritual movements that cropped up in the Middle Ages, Freemasonry, the Cathars, Rosicrucians, all derivatives,
right,
of the Gnostics,
right,
in one form or another. The Tarot was Gnostic symbology driven underground. They put it in the form of cards and symbols on cards and so forth. Gnosticism has pervaded our lives more than anybody realizes. They don't realize it because they don't know what Gnosticism is. But if people knew what Gnosticism is, they'd start to readily see examples of it in our everyday life.
Well, to me, it's like the difference between realistic painting and abstract painting. I love abstract paintings because it captures the essence of something without getting so obvious about it. It has to be so concretized.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be representational. And to me, spirit, it's like God's brushstroke. I mean, it's just, you know, there's a lot of references to that kind of idea, even in the Bible, about the spirit goes where it was, like the wind. It goes where it will, and nobody can trace it. That, to me, is the essence of mysticism.
Well, there's a very interesting quote from the Gnostic Gospel of Philip, and that truth comes into this world in symbols and images. It will come in no other way.
Mm-hmm.
The dividing line between the Orthodox and the Gnostics was that the Orthodox developed a very literal story of of the Jesus story, a literal version of the Jesus story, whereas the Gnostics tended to look at the symbology behind it, and there's more truth in symbology because those archetypes that the Gnostics tapped into really more accurately describe the higher dimensions than obviously something material can describe them. So, you know, for instance, just a simple analogy, you take a look at the nativity, okay? In Orthodox view, the nativity was the physical birth of Jesus. In the Gnostic view, it was the advent of a new light coming into the world, new information coming into the world.
Right.
You know, the resurrection became the blood sacrifice of the body of a particular individual, which is Jesus in Orthodox theology. In the Gnostic version, the resurrection was the crucifixion of the ego in order to come to that higher perception that we can develop once we quiet the ego. So you can readily see the differences, and I think you get a more holistic and better understanding when you don't pin yourself down to a literal point of view.
Absolutely, and I have felt like there has been a divide for many, many years in my life. If I've gone through various, you know, religions and orthodox paths, and I always felt like there was the dividing line was kind of like an intelligence thing. Because to understand abstract realities, you have to have a sense of your own worth. And it can't be so literalized. Literalized stories give comfort to unthinking minds in a way. They want everything really simple, like this is how it goes. They don't want to walk around like, oh wow, this could be any way. We could change this over here. It freaks some people out to have it change so much. And it has to do with self-esteem, and it has to do with courage.
Well, I think you just cited one of the reasons why the Orthodox prevailed over the Gnostics is because there's always more people who are less willing to take full responsibility for their spirituality and go to a church and have somebody tell them the way it is, or basically go to confession and have the priest absolve you and go home and feel like you've accomplished something. When you're going on the other path, the mystical path, there's more work involved in it. And you know, you have to spend more time in order to study and contemplate and, you know, get into those things. Mysticism or mystical experiences do not come cheaply. They do not come easily. So there were always more people. And, you know, it's the nature of the world. I mean, you know, the Bible says that Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden now to till the soil by the sweat of their brow. More people are concerned with surviving and putting bread on the table, getting the kids through college and so forth, than they are, you know, to devote time to, you know, to issues like this. But in the long run, You pay a price for it, and the world pays a price for it in the long run.
I even look at it like, you know, those are, I call them rest point lifetimes, where you go into an Orthodox lifetime where everything's safely structured for you. It's an artificial security because ultimately the universe is Gnostic. Mm-hmm. It is mystical. Mm-hmm. So you can go through these incarnations where it feels very safe, but ultimately we all go through this.
Well, the analogy I would use, the metaphor I would use is there's nothing... I do not criticize people who are fundamentalist or orthodox, and I'm not necessarily even saying that there's something wrong, and there's nothing that's disrespectful in the book towards that point of view. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is this: if you want to get the whole picture of what's going on around you, do you do it from the bottom of the hill or the top of the hill? Okay?
Good.
So you know, I think when you narrow down the definitions and the possibilities of understanding life to a formula like the Orthodox Church has, there's some truth into that you can always derive from it.
Right.
But when you sort of go up the mountain and expand your focus and look at it more in the symbolic and, you know, at the level that the Gnostics and the other mystics did, you're just looking at the same picture from a higher perspective, and you're encompassing more possibilities. And by getting a bigger picture, you learn more.
Absolutely. Peter, I want to ask you the last question I ask everybody in the show. It's been a fascinating conversation, but I'd love to hear your answer to this. If there were one thing you could tell the whole world that they really need to know, but they just don't seem to be getting, what would that one thing be?
Buy my book.
All right. I think that's a great answer. You put a lot of work into it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.